Hello everyone, just a quick note before we get to the episode. This is part two of our planned multi-part Silmarillion reread series. While you can listen to this episode without knowledge of prior events, it is recommended that you listen to part one of the series, which was Vassals of Kingsgrave episode number 147. Also, the Silmarillion can be a bit of an info dump and overwhelming at times, and some readers are scared away by all of the elven family trees and similar names, which begins in this episode. But have no fear, as long as you keep in mind that Melkor, or Morgoth, is the evil god and main enemy, and that the elven king Finwë and his descendants are the main good guys, you've got the basic plot of the Silmarillion.
They develop a very precise speech because they like they're basically grammar Nazis, like all Stannis.
I didn't say it. The German guy said Nazi.
Sorry. I don't know. I'm not conscious about it.
I'm sorry. I had to mention it though. Didn't say Nazi. Welcome everyone to Vassals of Kingsgrave. This is going to be our second discussion of the Silmarillion series we have going. We'll be discussing today the first six chapters of the Quintus Silmarillion, which is the beginning of days through of Feanor and the unchaining of Melkor. We're joined today by five other vassals, and we have a first-time podcaster with us, Beric. So if Beric, you want to introduce yourself, and then we'll just go around in alphabetical order.
I'm Mathieu. I'm Beric on the forums. I've been asked many times to come on the VOK before, but until now I had no idea how, so I'm glad to be here. Yeah, I'm actually from Belgium, so it's a different time over here than it is in the US, so yeah, I should probably be in bed, but yeah, it's fine.
Well, thank you for making it. I know it's a work sometimes, but did you want to say a little bit of how you got into Tolkien, what else you've read by him, and what your...
I actually got into Tolkien in 2002, actually. When I moved to Belgium, because that was when I was watching the movies first. I first watched the first one, then I wanted to read the books, and I read the Lord of the Rings before I watched all the other films, and then actually I reread The Hobbit because I read it as a young child, but I had no idea that it was related in any way to the same story, actually. I was just, like, I didn't remember the author or anything, so I reread it afterwards. And then I got into the Silmarillion and I read it once and I listened to the audiobook ever since because it's just so much easier.
Did you read it in German originally or was it in English?
Oh yeah, I read all the books in German, actually. I have a French edition somewhere of the first Lord of the Rings book, but yeah, generally I read them in German, but the names are basically the same. There are no translation literally of the names. They just use the same ones.
Right.
I have The Hobbit in English as well, so I'm probably going to try to read it in English as well, but until now I haven't been able to do that, but yeah.
You're a better man than I.
All right, so everyone else wants to introduce themselves?
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm Windiel on the forums.
This is Shane, East Texas Direwolf on the forums.
This is Brett, White Raven on the forums.
This is Matt, Varley on the forums.
And this is Greg, Claudius the Fool on the forums. So basically the format we're going to do is to do a brief, or kind of as brief as possible, chapter recap, and then get into the discussion proper.
So basically we're going to read this book for everybody.
Yeah, it's kind of strange because some of the chapters are only two or three pages, but literally there's something on every single line. So we'll try not to be too repetitive, but, you know, what would a good review be without being a little repetitive? So I believe, Brett, you're going to do the honors for the chapter one?
I'm going to try my best.
All right.
All right, my chapter was of the beginning of days. So it begins with the first war before Arda was fully shaped and before anything grew or walked upon the earth, and Melkor was just destroying everything that the Valar ever made until Tulkas the Strong heard about the war going on in the Little Kingdom and he came to aid the Valar. And his wrath and laughter scared the pants off poor Melkor, and Melkor fled from Arda, creating a long peace. But Melkor was not finished, and he brooded in the outer darkness, becoming darker, and planned his revenge. So during the peace, the Valar calmed the planet and readied it for life, and Yavanna planted seeds, and Alae made two mighty lamps that Varda filled with light, and Manwë hallowed them. They were set on pillars in the far north and the far south of Middle-earth. They have names, but they don't matter because they're going to get destroyed next paragraph. Spoiler, sorry about that. So all of Middle-earth was bathed in the light, and everything began growing, and the color green was invented. And the Valar dwelt in the middle, where the two lamps blended together to make like a light from both of them, and they lived on an island in the middle of a great lake named Almoran. Now, does anybody think that a great lake is pretty unimpressive for a name? I'm thinking Christopher Tolkien put that in.
That's what it needs to say, actually. It's you know, just the it's really accurate, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's capital G, capital L, Great Lake.
Sounds like a good hobbit name, but the elves aren't typically very hobbitish.
Right. Hobbitian. I think it's Hobbitian, Shane.
And my theory is that the elves actually, they smoked lots of hobbit weed between the Silmarillion and the Lord of the Rings, actually. So probably at some point they just said, let's write Great Lake.
Does anybody really remember what it was called anyway? No, because it was around before we were born.
Yeah, we weren't even there for any of this shit yet.
That was the Valar's bad. Like, yeah, we forgot to name that. Sorry about that. All right, so after the Valar did all this work, they decided to rest and feast to their achievements. And Melkor had spies among the Maiar, and he knew the plan of rest and celebration. He called all his converted spirits to him and planned his return to Arda to reign as king over all. During the celebration, Tulkas married Nessa, the sister of Orome, who must have been a panther in the sack because she wore Tulkas out and he fell asleep. Melkor decided this was his moment. He descended upon Middle-earth in the far north, unseen, and started building his vast fortress named Atumno in the mountains. The Valar, they were pretty clueless to his return because they weren't paying any attention. They were just having their little party. And then all the green things up north started dying and getting sick, and evil came, and the fly was born, so you know that's evil.
It was like Ebola in Middle-earth.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
And that's when the Valar knew that Melkor had returned, because flies were around all of a sudden. So they started searching for his underground lair. But before the Valar were prepared, Melkor struck and destroyed the lamps, causing chaos and destruction, and even destroyed Almoran, marring Arda, so that the first designs of the Valar could never be restored. After destroying the lamps, Melkor tucked tail and ran for Atumno, fearing as he was pursued by Manwë and Tulkas. He arrived at Atumno and hunkered down. The Valar chose not to do battle, for they had to calm the earth. So they tried to save as much of the earth as they could. They decided war would be ill-advised until they knew where the children of Iluvatar would come from. They did not want to risk them being caught in the crossfire. So right there, I just want to stop. Does anybody want to talk about the Valar deciding not to do anything about Melkor?
Well, it has sort of a World War II vibe to it, because, I mean, they don't necessarily know how strong he is necessarily, I think. They don't know how much destruction that would cause. So I guess that what the main idea is that they actually make a moral choice. But at the same time, yeah, we can see that this might present some problems, because he goes unchecked and he can always say, you know, well, screw you. You're not doing anything, right? I mean,
yeah.
Okay, so they summarize a lot of stuff before we get to the Quintus Silmarillion proper. So is this the first time Melkor kind of starts messing up Middle-earth?
Yeah, well, this is the second time, because the first time it was when Tulkas first came and like scared him away, and then he came back down after they had their little party. So it's actually the second time.
Well, yeah, the first time it was when they had the ongoing battle where Melkor raised lands, or, you know, Manwë raised lands and Melkor destroyed them, and that went back and forth for a while, which I think was before Tulkas came, right? That was what was said in, like, the Vala Quenta. But yeah, so because some of the narration, he jumps around where he'll say stuff in one chapter that actually hasn't happened yet.
But I guess the only thing that we could say is that he probably saw what a nice party they were having, and he was saying, damn it, just when I think I'm out, they pull me back in. Right, like this kind of thing where he's sort of like he can't control himself, to be honest. In this, I mean, I guess that's sort of what he is now. He's kind of just bent on destruction. If evil exists in the created world, then that means that it is also part of Iluvatar, right? So the only question is how much free will does Melkor actually have in causing destruction? Because if it's part of the plan that he eventually has to be a tool for evil to work its ways, then probably that means that it was sort of foreseen as well, even though he might think it comes from outside of the creation. So when he sort of disrupted the music, I think that might actually be already part of the big picture. So I don't know exactly how much free will there exists in Iluvatar's creation.
I mean, he like created him to be bad.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the idea, because if everything is Ilúvatar, then, you know, everything that Melkor seems to think he brought into it is also part of Ilúvatar, probably, which means that Ilúvatar has a bit of a douchey side as well, but, you know, that's probably just as well.
The music of, I've always thought of that the music was, you know, the Valar were shown the music of Ilúvatar, which was Ilúvatar's thought, and then they each wove their own theme into it, so Melkor definitely chose to do what he did, you know, by attacking and deciding to be destructive. And that was his, that necessarily didn't come from Ilúvatar, even though it was all one song, but it was like he was choosing what to do. But there is the whole question of free will and to what level do they actually have free will? Is it all preordained? And if so, what's the point of trying to change it?
With Almoran destroyed, the Valar had no place in Middle-earth to live, so they moved to the westernmost parts of Arda, to the borders of the world. They fortified this new dwelling and raised a great mountain range between their land and Middle-earth called the Pelori Mountains, the highest mountains on Earth. On the highest point of the highest mountain, Manwë set his throne. From there, with Varda, they could see and hear almost everything to the easternmost regions of Arda. The land on their side of the mountains was named Valinor. The Valar stored up much light there and created a land greater than Middle-earth, even in the spring before Melkor's return. Even the very stones and waters were hallowed, and there was no stain or corruption to be found. After they finished Valinor and the plain beyond the mountains, they built their city of Valimar. Before its western gate, there was a green mound Yavanna hallowed, and sang a song of great power in which she put all of her thoughts that grow into things that grow. Nianna thought in silence and watered the land with her tears. And as the Valar sat in silence upon their thrones of council, and all right, I'm going to try to say this. Mahanaxar? Anybody? The Ring
sure.
of Doom?
Go for it.
Be all right. Right.
It's one of my favorite words that he created. Yeah.
Yeah. It looks awesome. It's just hard to say.
My favorite word is Helcaraxa, which is
Helcaraxa. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the icy.
Those X's, those X's get us.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just the X in it. Yeah.
I feel like Aule made this word because he loves X's. Like, he wrote the dwarven language, so he must have been the one. All right. So anyway, so the Valar sat in silence upon their thrones in the council, and the two trees began to grow. The only sound being Yavanna's chanting and the falling of Nianna's tears. They were the trees of Valinor, and everything created by Yavanna, they had the most renown. The first tree to flower was Telperion. He had leaves of dark green that beneath were as shiny as silver, and from his flowers there was a dew of silver light ever falling. The second was Laurelin, and she had leaves of young green with the edges of glittering gold. Flowers upon her branches were yellow flame and formed each to a glowing horn that spilled a golden rain upon the earth. And from the blossom came forth a warmth and a great light. In 7 hours each tree waxed to full and waned again to naught, and each awoke once more to life an hour before the other had ceased to shine, giving 1 hour of light from both. The birth of the trees was the beginning of the counting of time. And Varda collected light and water from them and stored them in great vats, so saving up for the future there. So back on Middle-earth, the hour appointed by Ilúvatar for the coming of the elves was coming closer. But Middle-earth laid in twilight beneath the ancient stars that Varda created long ago, and the darkness of Melkor reigned supreme. He walked abroad in many shapes of power and fear, and wielded cold and fire from the tops of the mountains to the deepest places of earth. He brought forth cruelty, violence, and death. At this time, few of the Valar came to Middle-earth. Aule sat and created his bullshit in his mansions. Manwë looked out over the lands and was brought news of the land by spirits in the forms of hawks and eagles. But even Manwë could not see into the impenetrable dark of Melkor's shadows. Yavanna would venture out and repair the works of her labors in Middle-earth, and often urged the Valar to war with Melkor before the firstborn came. Orome often hunted in the lands of Middle-earth, pursuing to death the monsters and fell creatures of Melkor, riding upon Nahar, his silver steed with golden hooves. He would sound the great horn Valarama, and evil fled away. Even Melkor quailed in Autumno, fearing the wrath to come. Almo alone never lived in Valinor and rarely went there. It was because of him that the waters of Middle-earth kept flowing and life kept going. He alone has never forsaken Middle-earth and never will. And that's pretty much it, except for the stuff about men being most like Melkor and they give Manway a headache.
I always have a problem with fiction when it comes to free will, because usually it's seen as something evil. It's like people saying you don't have any free choice to help others. Like, it's always cast in a negative light. So I don't know exactly if that's sort of like the influence of the religious subtext by Tolkien seeping in. For example, he was a devout Catholic, right? So I think the idea that sort of man is most like Melkor, etc. It's sort of the idea of, you know, the Garden of Eden, you know, don't you eat that apple, right? It's like,
yeah.
So I guess this is sort of an analogy, even though he hates analogies.
In comparison to elves, like, Melkor corrupted a lot of men. So, like, they chose to follow him. Yeah, but he stole elves and he convinced men to follow him.
Right, right. So he didn't have to corrupt men to follow him. He just convinced him.
The fact that the Valar originally thought that Middle-earth was going to be their hangout, I find that odd, because everything that comes later, it's all like they forsake Middle-earth. Middle-earth is this other place, but originally they actually wanted they made that their dwelling, and they only went to Amon in the end because they needed defense, basically, from Melkor, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Which just shows how powerful he actually is, right? Because he can hold his own against all of them, but at the same time, it's a bit inconsistent as well, because if Tolkas sort of sends him fleeing, then basically they just need to trot him out every time, you know, send him over like Tolkas, you know, beat him up a couple of times, you know, just, you know, what are you doing, knucklehead?
But I don't feel like Melkor would ever go toe-to-toe with anybody. He's more of a like, haha, I destroyed what you built, and then he runs away. He very rarely stands up to someone.
Does anyone know what, like, hallowed is? Because they hollow a lot of stuff, and Melkor still fucks it up.
I think hallowing, I actually looked at it, it's the art of making something holy, to consecrate something, basically, because there's a lot of fraud.
Right, I get that, but, like, obviously it doesn't work.
Well, it kind of does.
Well, it's still, of course, more powerful.
It, like, burns him to walk on it and stuff.
Yeah, but that's, like, an annoyance. It's not stopping him.
It's like the flies.
Yeah.
It's their answer to flies.
Yeah, he's not a vampire, so it's not like you just sprinkle holy water on it and it makes everything right, right?
We get the two trees, which are the thread that everything is kind of built around, is the two trees of Valinor.
The start of time.
Exactly. It's the beginning of time. And, you know, throughout a lot of Tolkien's writings, trees and nature are very important and almost reverential. You know, he was obsessed with trees and they were the epitome of goodness and what's good in life. So it makes sense that he would have these two trees that are almost angelic and holy beings in and of themselves. And it's interesting that all the trees that come later, none of them give off light. It's almost the light of Varda is the driving force behind them, and that's what eventually goes into the Silmarils also. These aren't just trees, they're like crazy holy trees that shine light also. Question about when he talks about giving spirits in the shape of hawks and eagles, did you guys think that these are like Maiar coming to be an eagle or a hawk, or are these just, you know, he has control over the hawks? Because if the great eagles are actually spirits, then that means like the eagles that show up later are actually like on par with Sauron and those guys.
But these are, I mean, they're different. I mean, the Maiars are not all the same power and rank, right? I mean, it's at the same time, I feel like this is actually a very good connection to the eagles in The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, because at least now you know why they always come at the end, like, rescuing everybody. Because they're sort of like the emissaries of the Lord of the World, basically. So, like, you know, they're sort of meant to help everybody. At the same time, it is a Deus Ex Machina.
And I think it makes more sense why they can talk if they are Maiar. So I prefer to think of it that way.
But even the little birds can talk, like in The Hobbit, like little sparrows and stuff. Are they Maiar?
Yeah, but he also wrote The Hobbit basically as a children's book, and he had to edit a lot of it. So as far as I know, there really aren't many talking animals in Lord of the Rings. It's much more grounded in reality. And I think that was one thing that doesn't really...
Reality?
You know what I mean. Talking reality.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting the way he ended this chapter. He talks about elves and men, you know, about the gifts. And I wish this was in a chapter where the elves and men actually showed up, because it would have made a lot more sense.
I think it's actually very important to mention that the elves are immortal and that men are actually capable of dying of natural...
That's what they talk about. But basically, the elves are immortal. They don't die unless they waste in grief or they're slain in battle. But the men, it's a gift. It's not a punishment. It's a gift. The fact that they're not bound to the world. They go somewhere else that the elves don't know.
And the elves are basically there to make the world more beautiful, and that's it.
Sort of ornament, because they're all called I mean, the fair, or I don't know, the golden, or this, I mean, silver head, or something like that. It's all shiny. It's
art. It's art. And Tolkien talks about that in the letter in the introduction about how art, you know, is magic, basically. Like, that's the what the elves do is they're making the world a more beautiful place, even though that sounds super corny. But that's what they're doing. But we can, I think we can move on to chapter 2 of Aule and Yavanna. Shane, you want to do your recap for that one?
Yep, I'm ready. Aule, that's how you pronounce that?
Yes, sir.
I've said Aule. I know there's a umlaut in there, right?
I think it's actually, when I listen to it in German, they say they pronounce it like really, like Aule, like really, really strong.
Well, we don't got to those dots in English, so we say American.
yeah, they don't have the dots in German.
Chapter 2. Aule makes the dwarves in secret. He desired the coming of the elves and men, and he wanted to teach his lore and craft. The form of elves and men was unclear to him, but he knew he had to make them strong because Melkor was showing his ass all over Middle-earth. He didn't want them to get hurt. So he came up with the form that the dwarves are in. He knew the Valar wouldn't be down with the dwarves, so he made them in secret, and he made 7 fathers of the dwarves and hid them under mountains. Iluvatar, of course, knows what's up. And interestingly enough, he waits until Aule is done, and then he pops up and says, "What the fuck? Why are you doing this? You knew this was beyond your power to create real life." He said, "These are basically just puppets." And Aule kisses ass like a champ. He says he wanted to share the world that Iluvatar made and to love and teach. And he also turns it back on Iluvatar and basically says, "This is the way you made me. You know you made me this way. So really, it's your fault." Aule offers to destroy the dwarves, and he moves to do so, but Iluvatar says no, and he forgives Aule and gives the dwarves true life. Iluvatar says he will not correct Aule's work, and he'll leave the dwarves as they are, and he will not allow them to go out into the world before the elves and men. So he puts the dwarves to sleep and says there will eventually be strife between the children of, or his children of adoption and his children of choice. We're told here again how the dwarves are made strong to resist Melkor. They'll live longer than men. Elves believe they return to the earth in stone when they die, but page flip. Dwarves think that they go into halls of Mandos that are set apart for them, and where they will eventually serve Aule and help him recreate the earth after the last battle, which that's something we can return to, this last battle. First I've heard of it. Curious if it comes up again. They also believe...
It's not important.
It's not.
They also believe that the 7 fathers will be reborn again and again. Aule goes home, tells Yavanna what went down. She says, "Oh, that's good." Oh, but because Aule didn't tell her what was going on, and he didn't fill her until after the fact, the dwarves will not love the things she created, like the little animals and the trees, and they will only love the things that they make with their hands, like Aule, coincidentally, like their father. And they will cut down a lot of trees. Now, something we can come back to after the I'm done reading here. Is this something she is declaring or something she's foreseeing? I don't know. I'm not sure. Because it seems like if it's something she's declaring, she's kind of shooting herself in the
foot. I think she declares she foresaw it.
I think it's sort of like, foresight, something, even though Mandos is the official guy for the future and the past and everything. What I find interesting, though, is that we see a lot of creatures that are linked to Aule in Tolkien's world, right? I mean, to a certain extent, Sauron, dwarves, and all that stuff, they're all very influential, but Aule himself is actually not that complex of a character, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically he never leaves his like little workshop or whatever.
But we're about to get to the only funny part in the entire Silmarillion, so Shane,
oh, take I us love
there?
It.
Yeah. I know. I was so pissed when Shane
called
me.
Tell me you're going to quote it.
I don't know. I'm paraphrasing. Let's see. Aule says the elves and men will also consume resources like the dwarves, and that Yavanna's things are important, but elves and men will have dominion over them, though respectfully. Yeah, we'll see. Yavanna thinks about it, and so she goes to see Manwë and says, "So Aule said the elves and men are going to have dominion over my shit I've been working on all this time." Manwë says, yeah, why? Yavanna says, "Well, that sucks. I'm busting my ass out here, making little trees and little animals and whatnot, and Melkor's tearing my shit up, and is everything I make going to be under the minion of somebody else? Manwë says, okay, if you could keep one thing, what would it be? Yvanna says, well, all my shit's pretty awesome. And everything contributes to the whole, making everything else more awesome. But the animals can kind of look after themselves, sort of, and the plants can't. And among the plants, the trees are the best. So I think the trees ought to be able to kick some ass and protect the other plants. Manwë says, that shit is whack. Yvanna says, yeah, well, in the beginning, while we were singing, you were singing about the clouds, I was singing about the trees. And in the song, that's what they did. The song is everything in your face. So Manwë sat there looking annoyed, and he thinks back to the song, and then he suddenly remembers the part of the song Yvanna is talking about. That he
just wants
forgot.
Her to leave him alone.
Then Manwë said, whatever, I heard that part of the song. Anybody think I didn't hear it? Speak up now. Okay, that's what I thought. Well, behold, when the children awake, there will be ints, and they will kick some ass occasionally.
When they can be roused to do so.
But not too hasty, right?
Yeah, not too hasty.
Exactly. And he says, Yvanna, you remember that smart ass? I mean, when we were singing together and we made the eagles? Huh? You remember that? And Yvanna was like, all right, the eagles, now I remember. And they'll live in the trees. And Manwë was like, well, what? Oh, no, sweetheart. They're going to live up in the mountains because that's the highest place on Middle Earth. Because that is, you know, the only place good enough for them because they're my eagles. But the ants, they can live on the ground with your trees. So Yvanna, she strolls on home to tell Alul, he's working as a smith. Doom, doom, doom. And she says, hey, your dwarves, they better watch out because there's going to be ants and they're going to be protecting the trees. What do you think about that? And Alul looks up and says, dwarves still going to need wood. Doom, doom. Back to the smith.
Which is probably the most awkward ending, I mean, of any chapter. He usually ends these chapters on these, you know, these rousing, you know, images and prose, and then it's literally, they're going to need wood. End of chapter. Yeah.
This is actually a much lighter chapter, which I actually like, because it's still at the moment, I mean, it's after everything has sort of been put into, I mean, there's been peace, sort of. So I guess this is sort of a moment of levity compared to what's to come. So I guess we should probably be thankful for this chapter.
I am.
Because it's really, I mean, it shines a lot of light on what's been happening since Melkor got cast out. And also it gives an explanation reasonably as to where some creatures came from. So I'm actually really thankful for it. I don't know that the dwarves actually know of this story. We'll just have to imagine that they don't.
I feel like if they knew it, then they'd take more pride in it, because it's kind of weird that the whole, you know, the Valar are always waiting for the elves to show up, and they're waiting for the children of Iluvatar, but then the dwarves are technically created first, and then the ants are created then, so they're not first. And it kind of like messes with my head, like, the whole time you're waiting for the elves, and then you're like, oh, the dwarves, it was like a mulligan, like he made it, and then they went back.
I think the dwarves would definitely throw this in the elves' faces if they knew.
Yeah,
about
right.
I just think they're so secretive they wouldn't tell anybody anyway.
But they don't go to Valinor, so that they don't find out. They don't ever meet Aule. He's never there, right? So they don't. Think, except for Gimli,
They never find out like exactly how they were created. I think that's also why they have like a different mythology than the elves and the men.
The elves are like, you turned to stone, dude. They're like, no.
I think this is also something that might be the cause of the rivalry between the dwarves and the elves, because basically they're not firstborn. So it's like, the elves are probably just saying that we are the children of Iluvatar. You know, you go back to your place, right? And the dwarves are like, no, fuck you. We're not actually going to be pushed around by our status, right? We're also children of you know, of this world and so on. And so probably that's also partly why they are so antsy about the elves in general.
Yeah, well, we get all the strife in this chapter, basically. We know who's going to have trouble with who. You know, the elves are going to have trouble with the dwarves and the men, and they're also going to work together at times, but they will be at odds also. And it all comes because Aule didn't tell his wife what he was doing.
I got two theories after reading this chapter. I think it's funny how the trees in Middle-earth can just sometimes come alive. You know, like Old Man Willow in the forest, and then other trees. I think Yvanna, after all this went down, because she keeps going to Middle Earth and walking on Middle Earth. I think she starts giving the trees a little extra juice. Like, you know, here's a little something, you know, so they can kind of protect themselves a little bit at least. And the other theory I had was I read somewhere, I'm not sure if it was in one of these Silmarillion chapters or in, like, Unfinished Tales, but Yavanna is the one that chooses the Maya that eventually becomes Radagast.
There was a chapter in Unfinished Tales about the Astari, right? I think that was from Unfinished Tales.
Okay. I'm thinking when they're picking the Maya to go to Middle-earth and fight the enemy, she's like, all right, Gandalf and Saruman, they can handle this. Radagast, you can. Like, yeah, you got to fight the enemy, but while you're down there, when you're really there, you're there to look after our shit, the stuff we've been working on. And that's why Radagast, you know, he's just all about the little animals and the trees and stuff.
And those two blue wizards were like, F this, we're just going to keep walking. They just keep going.
Yeah, I feel bad for them. They don't get mentioned at all, actually.
Oh, there was a on the video game, Shadow of Mordor.
Let's keep it canon, Chain. Let's keep it canon.
Hey, it's
canon. There's a cool reference. I haven't listened to the podcast yet because I'm not finished with the game. Yeah, but there's right. In the appendices, one of the bad guys, they say a rumor is that he earned his position by handing Sauron the head of two blue wizards from the back.
Nice. Making me angry.
Oh my gosh.
I love it. Okay,
yeah, that's
I love
probably
it.
Not canon, but we'll fine with it.
It is now.
Anything to spice it up a little.
Yeah.
Does anybody think it would have been crazy fun, like, if Christopher Tolkien left this chapter out and everybody didn't get this, like, the origin of the dwarves or the Ents? Do you think people would have been pissed?
Yeah, I think if he concentrates so much on the elves, like, people like Shellfish will probably say, well, that was a waste of space. It's like, we didn't even get to see the dwarves or, you know, the Ents or whatever. It's just like, this is actually a nice... I know this is sort of like the story of the elves and so on, but at the same time, like, their actions affect everyone else. So if you don't set the stage for everyone else, I mean, there's not much investment that you can get from it, right?
Yeah, and this is one of the few areas where, I mean, we know that most of this was written by Tolkien at one point, but the final product we get, we don't really know what is originally Tolkien. And I accept it because if anyone had the right to do it, it was Christopher. But Tolkien was all about telling the Elves story and the history of the Eldar and their whole mythology that I can completely see him like being, we need to tell the Elves, the Dwarves also, because they're a big part of what happens later. So if there's anything that, not that he made up, but he might have had to... edit, I don't know, or add, you know, but I can see that as something that he might have had to like throw in there to please the readers, because when people picked up this book in 1977, I'm sure they expected answers, and that was a big answer that they would have wanted to get.
It just, some of it doesn't necessarily feel like Tolkien writing, because it's not as like eloquent and beautifully written. That's why I kind of like feel like maybe there was some of it in like his notes and stuff, but Christopher Tolkien really had to just not make it up but kind of throw this all together.
Right. I know we're all tiptoeing around. No one wants to say he made it up, but we know he must have made it. The whole process. He wrote 12 books on how it all came together, but, you know, maybe Guy Gavriel Kay, who actually was his, like, assistant through all this in 30 years after everyone passes away, will be like, hey, this is how the Silmarillion actually came together, and I wrote it. But there were a couple biblical stuff. Matthew, you brought up about the comparisons with Abraham and Isaac, and that's definitely there. But one of my other things I picked up on was where Manwë goes into his, like, hey, I remember mode, and he says, do then any of the Valar suppose that I did not hear all the song, even the least sound of the least voice? There's a Bible quote, Matthew 10:29, where yet not one sparrow falls to the ground without your father's knowing it. And that's a quote that can take in either way, that God knows everything and he's responsible for everything, or he at least knows about everything and will help you through it. But I kind of thought that was another, I don't know if he's making a direct comparison, but the idea that he knows everything that's going on and, you know, you can't hide anything from him.
Can you? What's Melkor doing right now? I don't know.
Which sucks, yeah. Because he doesn't essentially tell them what's going to happen later, which is a bit, yeah.
Yeah, but from a composition perspective, like if Iluvatar wrote the music, then he's aware of all the voices. But if it's improvisation, then he doesn't know what all the Valar sung.
Can it be both, though? It can't, right?
it It's either one or the other.
Yeah, I know. And that's the constant problem we keep coming back to.
As far as the text is concerned, we don't have any confirmation. So it's probably best. I mean, I like a bit of ambiguity about these kind of things because we have a good discussion about it.
Yeah.
Also, the fact that the dwarves, you know, they're like, hey, yeah, we go to the halls of Mandos, but we're separate. We've got separate halls over there. I like that. That they have that animosity towards the elves so much that they don't want to hang out with them in the afterlife.
Oh, I just wanted to concrete point it out because we talked about it in the Shadow of Mordor podcast, but the dwarves can't be corrupted by the rings like men can because their bodies won't turn to wraith. Like that can't happen to them because that's how Aule built them. Because they were asking about it on the other podcast.
Nice.
I mean, they can become corrupted like mentally, but they can't turn into a wraith. He can't take over their souls or anything like that.
There's no
Aule built them to resist.
Nazgul version of dwarves anywhere.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Which is weird because hobbits can apparently, after they get wounded by a Morgul blade, they can sort of turn slightly.
Yeah.
Well, at least that's what the film implies, right? I mean, I don't know. And it's a bit weird that the dwarves would be so singular, but at the same time, it's also interesting, I think. It's kind of nice to know that creatures that are sort of created by Aule cannot be corrupted by Sauron, who is a disciple of Aule. So it's really actually quite ironic.
I like that they're singular because they are singular. They're the only ones not created by Iluvatar. So it's interesting that they're just like, yeah, that doesn't affect us. It affects you bitches because Iluvatar didn't see it coming.
All right. So I've got chapter 3, which is of the coming of the elves and the captivity of Melkor. And this is one of the longer chapters, and I just got it down to about 3 paragraphs. So a lot of stuff happens, but we'll get through it.
You got the best one.
I let everyone pick. Everyone went for the funny parts and for the for all those the elves and all the names, but I like this one. Okay, so Melkor builds his stronghold named Utumno in the far north of Middle-earth. He then builds another fortress to the south of it and names that Angband. He gathers all his forces of demons and monsters to him, as well as several spirits of fire, which are called Balrogs. He takes up command in Utumno and gives command of Angband to Sauron, his captain. The Valar know that the time for the coming of the children is almost at hand. Varda creates bright new constellations of the stars so the children may have light. The children finally awaken by the shores of Cui Vienen, which is also one of my favorite names in this whole book. It flows off the tongue like no other name, which lies near the inland sea of Helkar. They name themselves the Quendi, which signifies those who speak. Orome finds the children on one of his hunts. The elves are in awe of Orome. Some are freaked out and run away. Some of them are eventually captured by Melkor and corrupted and turned into orcs. Orome then returns to Valinor, and the Valar decide to get rid of Melkor, to rid Middle-earth of Melkor before he can destroy the children of Iluvatar or corrupt them. The Valar then march in force out of Amon into Middle-earth, and a great battle is fought in the northwest of Middle-earth. The landscape again is changed and damaged in the fighting. Melkor eventually retreats to his fortress of Utumno. The Valar place a magic dome of protection over the elves at Cui Vienen so they can just hang out and not worry about what's going on in the north, and they lay siege to Utumno. The Valar are eventually victorious, and Tulkas wrestles Melkor to the ground because that's what he does. Melkor is bound and chained and brought back to Valinor. The Valar did not find and destroy all of his servants, and Sauron, as well as many of the Balrogs and lesser captains, escape the Valar's wrath. This time, Melkor is sentenced to be imprisoned in Mandos for 3 ages of the world. We don't really know how long this time is, but it's a very long time. Orome returns to the elves at Cui Vienen and takes 3 ambassadors back to Valinor to see how awesome it is. He takes 1 ambassador from each of the elven groups, Ingwe of the Vanyar, Finwë of the Noldor, and Elwë of the Teleri. They go to Valinor, see the trees, and they just plain fall in love with the place. They then return to Cui Vienen and try to convince all the elves to move to Valinor permanently. Most of them agree to go west, but some stay behind and become the Avari, and this is the first sundering of the elves. Ingwe leads the Vanyar, Finwë leads the Noldor, Elwë and Olwë, since there's so many Teleri, they need to be led by 2 captains, so Elwë and his brother Olwë lead them. Some of the elves were scared along the way, and they turned back or were left behind. The Vanyar eventually and the Noldor reach the western shores of Beleriand, and they're kind of freaked out by the sea. The Teleri are still hanging out. They're taking the long way, looking at every single thing along the way. And Orome goes back to Valinor to try to figure out the best way to bring the elves to Valinor safely.
I like that Almo blows his little roofie horn, and then they all decide they want to go over.
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe it's different when you're immortal, but, like, does anyone feel like someone should have been, like, come on, get the fuck up, Teleri. Come on. Like, where are you?
The Teleri are the worst. I mean,
they had to move a freaking island to get them across the sea.
Yeah, that's sort of, like, they're special. They're the prize collection. You have to make sure that, yeah, you don't step on them by accident, right? So be sure, you know, you don't wake them up. Let them sleep for a couple of hours.
Yeah. For a couple centuries.
Yeah.
I was going to say, what I found striking is that they seem so childlike, and we're used to elves being so sophisticated and old, worldly. I guess. But, I mean, it's the beginning of the world, but...
Well, they're like toddlers pointing at something like, what's that? What's that? Yeah. What's that? Because they're brand new.
Let's give it three names.
Yeah, and let's give five names to everything.
Yeah. I'm also kind of surprised that, you know, you said some of the elves were left behind. Like, is there sort of policy? Isn't there kind of a no elf left behind policy? I don't know. It's really... It's interesting, because would the elves leave their companions behind, or is it that they don't have that much attachment to them?
Well, he makes the big deal of calling it the first sundering of the elves, and that this was a serious thing. It's not just, hey, I mean, these people were created together, they awoke to being together, and to leave some of them behind forever, as far as they know, is a big deal. But they also have this entire world to themselves, and they're going to, you know, go forth and prosper and make it their own. But it's a tough decision. I honestly don't know. Like, would you want to go out and hang out with the gods, or would you want to kind of make your own way and see what happens? It actually is a serious decision. And it seems like the one that stay behind because they're freaked out by Arame and his flaming horse. Melkor freaked them out a little bit, but they were actually scared of the Valar that came to protect them.
At least they made the decision to stay, whereas some of the Teleri just ended up not going to Valinor because they got distracted or something.
Yeah, they didn't hear the call. They probably just were, like, sleeping too much. It's sort of implied that it's a big deal in at least a lot of the rings, right? That when Arwen makes the choice, at least in the appendices, right? It's a bit... I think that this is... here, it's a bit underplayed because there's so many of them. So you don't get the sense of, yeah, this is a really big choice, because the Teleri, later on, as we'll see, they make the decision, oh, yeah, we actually do want to join them, but not really, but maybe we do, and I don't know. It's so complicated for them.
And we also get a little bit more of the world being grounded in reality, because when they name the constellations, they actually respond to actual constellations. You know, like the Sickle of the Valar is the Big Dipper. They mention Wilwarin, and if you go to the appendices, like, they actually tell you that Wilwarin is Cassiopeia, Menelmarkar is Orion. And I thought that was just really, it's something that's subtle, but it's there. And if you're like, oh yeah, that's the seven sickle, that could be the Big Dipper, which I thought was pretty cool.
Can we talk about the orcs?
Orc talk. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think this is actually really, really interesting, because at least originally it seems that orcs were meant to be corrupted elves, right? And then later, I mean, at least that's what I read in expanded material, like in the other Book of Lost Tales, etc. It seems to be that the author wasn't sure exactly how the origin of the orcs was going to work out. So it seems that at least at the beginning they were elves, but later on Melkor might have used men to make orcs as well.
Right, but it's dangerous when we start quoting from the Books of Lost Tales, because those actually show the evolution of this was going to be this and then this was going to be this, and it's tough to say at what point it became canon. That's why it's really very gray area, but I think we're meant to believe that eventually he crossed men with elves and orcs, and that's what made, like, the Uruk-hai. That's why they're, like, stronger and, like, super orcs, and the original orcs were just taken just from the elves. Basically, it just shows that Melkor can't create anything on his own that's intelligent. It's all, he has to mar and he has to corrupt stuff that's already created, which is one of his, like, always complaining points, like, man, I can't do anything myself. I've got to fuck up someone else's shit.
I feel sorry for these elves in this. It's like they're like children. They're like, some of them will get scared, you know, by seeing the gods walking by, and they'll run into the trees, and then Melkor snatch them up and go and torture them and turn them into orcs. That's kind of sucky.
But they still stayed.
You know that elves are children until they're 50, and they get, you know, they hit puberty once they're 50 until they're 100, and by 100 they're actually real adults, to be honest.
Where do we get that from? I missed that.
Yeah, part. I was just saying.
I looked it up. I looked it up on the Wikipedia page.
Okay, we gotta be sure of where that's coming from, because I know there's a lot of elf speculation out there.
But at least, okay, then let's say that this is speculative, but at the same time, if that's true, then probably they don't know what's actually happening, right?
But these elves, I assume they didn't wake up as babies crawling on the shore, like, woke up as fully fully formed beings. And because if there's elf babies, that's the cutest thing ever, but it's also, they don't die.
Well, if probably, you
that's probably why they had to sleep, actually. They probably had to sleep because it's like strawberries, right? They sort of grow underneath the earth when they're sleeping.
Elves are strawberries theory. Here we go.
In the Lord of the Rings podcast, we decided that they laid eggs and then they grew in the ground until they were full grown adults and then they hatched. That's what happens.
Actually, I have a dictionary that says that actually orcs multiply by probably laying eggs, but we're not. But they, even in that dictionary, they say they're not sure. So it's like it's not clear, but it's probably that they laid eggs. So I don't know. It seems like that would be something that fits with orcs.
Well, we can't get bogged down in the science, because anytime Tolkien gets bogged down in science, yeah, even like when they're talking about how long the days are and like the 14 hours, like that's kind of weird. Like, I don't want to know that they're reptiles, because that makes them reptiles.
It speaks also to the complaint that people have against Tolkien, that he's basically making them others, like that they are not relatable in any way. It's much easier to hate them if you don't give them any sort of, like,
of course. And but that's one of my favorite parts of Lord of the Rings, is when Sam is hearing the two orcs just have like a regular conversation. You're like, oh, they're actually kind of people too, you know. And that
they just wanted to get a little farm together after the war and grow some.
But you're not supposed to think that, because basically they kill every single orc and goblin they come across. And don't get me started on goblins. Where do they come from? Are they orcs?
I like to think that they're different. That they're different kinds of orcs, basically. But yeah, they don't go back. I mean, I guess all
they got
of them
less sunlight, I think.
Yeah.
This is I did the same thing with the dwarves. How we got a concrete, or at least a semi-concrete answer as to where they came from. We do have an answer to where do the orcs come from. But also, we find out the elves awake by Quivienen on the inland sea of Helkar. There's a whole debate apparently among Tolkien fans of where this actually is, and when I first read this, since there's no maps in the books that include Helkar, I tried to do extrapolate, and I feel like it has to be basically what becomes Mordor later on, because that whole area, we know that Mordor at one point was like a sea, and I think that this is like the eastern shore of Mordor is where it might have been Helkar at some point. And we know the land's been changed in the, you know, 20,000 years since then, but did anyone think like, did you want to find this on a map, or is this just another name they threw out there that, like, it's just a name and a location that we don't find?
No, I think it's a very important name. It's just that I have an atlas at home. It's Karen Wynne Fonstad's Middle Earth Atlas.
Yeah, I have that in front of me right now.
Yeah. So it's not in that one?
No, it is in that one, but this is her interpretation.
No, canon, yeah.
She has it there.
I just assume because they said, you know, the world has changed so much that it's kind of, you wouldn't be able to find it, or if you did, it would be pointless because it's not even the same place anymore.
Yeah, I agree with Shane. I think it's probably like under the water, or else it'd be like revered by the elves, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but if it's Mordor, then it's kind of interesting that what eventually became the center of evil and destruction is where the elves came from, because that might go with Tolkien's whole theme of like, yeah, there's good, but there's also bad, and whenever there's something good, there's something bad with it also.
I did. That is interesting, but I kind of pictured it being even farther off to the east. Like,
well, it's got to be far away, because they take a while just to get to the Misty Mountains, and that's like not even the halfway point when they're on their way back.
Yeah.
But we don't have to get bogged down in the details, but it is fun sometimes.
That's what we're doing, man.
I know. It is a great companion to the Silmarillion, is The Atlases of Middle-earth by Karen Wynne Fonstad. If you haven't checked it out, definitely check it out. It's a cool book. I believe, Alex, you're going to do number four.
Yes. Okay. So chapter four is of Thingol and Melian. Melian is a Maia who came to Middle-earth when the elves were created, and she is the wisest and the best singer of the people of Lorien. She has a lot of nightingale buddies who like to hang out and sing with her. Elwë, who later becomes known as Thingol, is the lord of the Teleri, who was in East Beleriand when his people were on their way to Valinor. One day, but since there's no sun and moon, I don't really think there's days. So one time, he was on his way through the woods of Nan Elmuth to visit his friend Finwë up in Noldor, when he suddenly became enchanted by the voice of Melian, who was having choir practice with her nightingale buddies. Elwë completely ditches Finwë and forgets what he was in the woods in for the first place, and follows the voice. He comes upon Melian in a clearing with the light of Aman in her face. Neither of them speak. They just hold hands and stand there for a couple hundred years. And most of Elwë's people just end up leaving Middle-earth without him, while he stayed there with Melian, later to become a king of the Grey Elves, the Sindar, those who stayed behind to stay with him. And he was then named Ilúvatar, which means King Greymantle in Sindarin. Together, Thingol and Melian have a daughter who is the fairest of all the children of Ilúvatar that was or shall be.
So that's the whole chapter?
That's the whole chapter.
Yeah, this is really the shortest chapter in the book.
I think this is not a spoiler. We will probably see more of them. You know, these are Maias, are basically, I don't know, they're sort of the equivalent of angels or demigods.
Well, Melian is, but not Thingol.
That's what I mean. It's probably sort of the idea behind it is they are both immortal, but in a different way. Different beings coming together and then have a child, which is probably the most talked about.
Basically, everything that comes later, it's because of these, you know, everything in Lord of the Rings is all wrapped up in this family tree that begins with Thingol and Melian.
Everything that, you know, Aragorn sort of mopes about and Arwen mopes about comes from this.
There is plenty of moping. But I do like you brought, it's all very chaste and it's almost like Arthurian. There's this, you know, meeting in the woods with the birds singing. It's very, Tolkien never writes sex, but this is the closest he comes to it, I guess. is just like this meeting of holding hands and gazing at each other under the stars, and everybody else just moves along.
They mingled their little avatar tails.
Right. As long as it's not Lysa screaming Peter, Peeper, making a baby. It's, I hope this is, you know, at least we're spared that kind of detail.
I think it's kind of interesting that we found out that the wizards, the Ishtari, are not unique in that, you know, Maia taking a physical form, staying on Middle Earth for a significant amount of time.
Right.
I imagine it would be it's a different process maybe or whatever, but
it's also weird. I mean, because the children, I mean, I suppose Melian took her form before the children actually awoke, right? It seems weird that she would know what they would look like, or at least what they, because she resembles a humanoid person. I mean, how would she know before they awoke? I mean, she doesn't have anything to mold her physical form after. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but maybe she can change her form. Like, once she saw elves, maybe she made a few adjustments. Yeah.
I could be the prettiest one of those. Watch this. Their meeting was just all a bet. Like, Melian's like, I bet you I can get their king to fall in love with me. They're like, nah, you fucking can't. She's like, watch me.
Oh my god.
It's the biggest Valar totally running joke.
Maybe the Maia just look like what you think. Maybe you see a reflection of yourself or a reflection of your own, what you think a being should look like.
Yeah, I mean,
so that elves would see elves, or men could see men.
Maybe Ilúvatar gave them all the same idea of
made in Ilúvatar's image, looks right? Like.
Yeah.
Except for the dwarves. So, those stupid bastards.
But they were made off what Aule, kind of the impression he had of what the elves and men were going to look like. Yeah. It wasn't fully formed in his mind.
They're like humanoid.
Yeah.
We shouldn't say humanoid, because there's no humans. They're elvenoids. Yeah.
Okay, elvenoids.
It's like they got two arms and two legs, and they poop out their butts, and this is what they look like.
And they all have beards.
Eldar don't poop.
50 eyes or something.
No, but they knew we were going to. It was in the music.
Right. Oh, right, I forgot that part.
Everybody poops. It's right in the music.
And it will eventually become a best-selling children's book.
So it's here, mine is chapter 5 of Eldamar and the Princess of Eldaria. Yeah, so the Vanya and the Noldor, they arrive at the western coast of Middle-earth, but there's a strait that separates Aman from Middle-earth, which is made of ice. The elves, they come over the Sirion stream, they see the sea for the first time, and so they have this longing, which I made a note is something that is mentioned again in Return of the King, because Legolas is actually longing for the sea.
To the sea, to the sea.
Yeah. So Ulmo greets them there. He takes literally an island that's far off, and he sort of makes a ship out of it, the ferry. He uses it to bring them over. The Vanya and Donaldo, they cross the sea on the island, and they arrive in Aman. It's said that the eastern part of the island is rumored to be the island Balar. And Osse, who is a Maya, often visits it. And so they tell her they remain in East Beleriand because they heard the call too late. But then they hear that Finwë and Ingwë had left as well. The Teleri, they go to the sea, they make Olwë their king. Osse teaches them in music and knowledge of the sea. The Teleri, they love the sea, and they are considered the best singers among the Sindar, which is a neat detail. And so the Noldo and the Vanya ask Ingwë to take the Teleri across. Osse is sad because he wanted their singing to be heard in the lands that he protected. And so he's like, why do I have to, you know? He's convinced some of the Teleri to stay, and they become the Palathrim.
Yeah, you guys, you don't need to go to heaven. Just stay here.
Yeah, you're fine where you are. Just stay with me. I don't want to be alone. And so they were the first sailors and the first to make ships. It's important to note that Círdan was their lord. So he's been around until the very end, right? From the very beginning. So Olwë wanted to go to Valinor, and the majority of the Teleri left as well. So the friends of Elwë Sengolo that remained called themselves Eglath, which is the Forsaken people. And they preferred to live in the woods and Forsaken hills rather than near the sea because it causes them sadness. I don't know how that look on a Nelf's face, actually, sadness. It's like, yeah. they always seem so ethereal. So the island of the Teleri so therefore becomes Tol Eressëa, which is a lonely island. And so you can still see Aman from it, but you're not necessarily in it. So it's like in between, right? And it led to differences in languages between the Teleri and the Vanya, and the Noldor, which I find interesting. Now come the family trees, which are, you know, very, very important. So there's Finwë, he is the king, and he was married to Miriel. She had Fëanor, and then he also later married Indis, who of the Vanya, and he had Fingolfin and Finarfin.
For the sake of brevity, I have moved the rest of Matthew's wonderful recap in regards to the family trees of the Eldar and Valinor to the after show. Matthew did a very informative and comprehensive recap, but as this chapter is so much of an info dump already, I have chosen to build it a little island and ferry it to the back of this episode. But just like Olmo, I left a little bit of it anchored here so you at least know what is going on, and who the first generation of elves born in Valinor are. Sorry for the interruption.
Teleri lived long on Tol Eressëa, and Olmo sends Osse, who is actually sad to teach them how to build ships. The Teleri, they prefer the coast, and the Noldor give them great gems, and that's the funny bit, and diamonds. And so basically, they either disperse it on the beach or they throw them in lakes. Like, it's like, yeah, we give you this present. Like, yay. Yeah, so the Teleri, their ships resemble swans, and they are in the havens of Alqualondë, which is like Olwë's house, right? And over time, the Vanya began to love the light of the trees more and more. And so they left Tirion, separated themselves from the Noldor. And so the Noldor remembered Middle-earth, and they remained in Kalakiria, which is the Pass of Light, or the hills of the valleys that are not far from the sea. Finwë was therefore king in Tirion, and Olwë was king in Alqualondë. But the High King of the Elves was Ingwë, who lived on the Taniquetil at Manwësfit. It's like, you know, this is like the big beauty contest where everyone sort of comes on stage and you see like every different individual who's going to become important later on.
I mean, these early chapters, there is an info dump, and it's tough to keep all these characters together sometimes. But it's good that we know. Finwë is the main guy. He's got three sons, and that family is basically where all the trouble comes from.
Yeah, I like the idea of sort of like taking an island and making it a ferry. But it's
weird, it's like, though, that they stop like, no, we don't want to go all the way. We want to almost get there and then live on the island. It's like taking the Titanic to New York and then sinking it in New York Harbor and never getting off the Titanic.
They want to have their eight and keep their cake and eat it too, right? So it's, they want to see it, but they don't want to necessarily go there. They're constantly in between both of these options. I mean, they sort of like from one day to the next, they sort of like, oh, I want to go. Maybe not.
That's so Teleri of them to do that.
That's probably what Shellfish hates about them. It's like, you know, they're so like, they have so, I wouldn't call it insignificant, but they have really small problems at this point.
Yeah, I found it weird that instead of like teaching the Teleri how to build ships, they just moved an island two or three times and then decided they weren't going to move the island anymore and teach them how to make ships.
And when they made the ships, they apparently didn't teach them how to make masts or sails, because then they had a bunch of birds pull the ships the rest of the way.
It's like, you know, we will you know, just give you the minimum necessary because we don't want to inconvenience you too much or something. You know, it's like, yeah, we don't want to take away your time. You know, just frolic around and sing and all that stuff.
Yeah, we also know that a lot of time is going by, that it seems like this is happening all at once. But if that happens, then it means that, not an age, but a long amount of time is going by that all this is happening. And I also like that it's the fact that you're building a society here. It's not just like we're all hanging out here, everything's great. Like, you've got different people doing different things, and Finway's kids are running off, you know, trying to explore, and Ingway's, they're just happy to hang out at the feet of God, basically. But I've always liked the Teleri when they get to Amon, and when they build their city of Aqualande. Yeah, like, they're gonna have a navy and they're gonna go explore. It just adds depth to the society and to the land that they're all living in.
What I find interesting is that we get sort of name dropping here and there, right? We get Galadriel, we get Círdan, we get Celebrimbor. Mm-hmm. Like, we get three of the, you know, of the big people. Especially, they're all ring bearers, right? I think Celebrimbor, wasn't he?
He
made the rings.
I'm sure he wore them at one point.
They're around since the very beginning, and it seems like they also all come from the same family. So, like, all the troubles right through the Third Age are sort of linked to the House of Feanor and Finwë, to be honest.
They say at a couple points that he does this weird thing where they say it's almost like a little what if scenario, where like some people say it would have been better if Finwë never remarried and had all those other kids, because none of this trouble would have happened. But at the same time,
but that's not his fault, right?
But it's an interesting narrative style that he mentions this, and then but then he kind of caps it by saying, but then all these other awesome people wouldn't have lived anyway. It's a really weird writing style. I love the book and I love everything that happens, but some points I have to like take a step back and be like, this doesn't make great narrative sense to throw this stuff in here. Not that we're writing, you know, critically, you know, making fun of it, but
I mean, I'm, you know, at least on the forums, I've sort of sometimes complained about the prose in A Song of Ice and Fire being a bit too like descriptive, and it's not really my thing. I mainly read the story because I find the characters really compelling. But here, it's definitely like this is a completely different level of stiff, right? It's I don't know. It's not engaging, and I can see why many people who wanted to read the book were disappointed, because it just wasn't a real story. It's more like a chronicle of the history of what happened.
Yeah, but in a historical account, you wouldn't tease things that are coming later, generally speaking.
Oh, that's true. As we said, probably it's also because parts of it were not written by him, by Tolkien himself, and they're based on notes. Christopher Tolkien had to sort of edit things down and change things around, and he's, just because he's related to Tolkien doesn't mean he has the same writing skills as well, right?
There's times that I wish that because we know he submitted a manuscript for the Silmarillion back before The Lord of the Rings was published. I wish I could just read that, even though it would be an earlier version of it, but at least it would be 100% what he,
complete,
you know, what he thought, even if names were changed. Like, Melkor used to be Melko, and like all the names got changed, but that's kind of what I wish I had. So we're going to get to our last chapter tonight, chapter 6, which Matt will be doing the recap for.
All right, so everything is like really awesome in Valinor right now, and the Noldor are happy, and they don't see an end to the work that they can do, and they're just having a time of their life. So Finwë weds this girl, Muriel, and they get it on, and she gives birth to Feanor. And being an overachiever, she gives all of her like spirit fire to him. So she's basically like running on fumes and goes to Lorien and just kind of passes away there. And eventually Finwë, he keeps on like calling her by all her names, which I'm sure, you know, Muriel wasn't the only one.
but then finally just stops going to Lorien. So Feanor is like really subtle in mind and in his work, say he does, and he learned a lot from Matan, who was the who is his father-in-law, and so it just kind of develops his skills more and more and more. So let's see, they have the seven sons, which we already went over. And all of them are kind of hot-headed too, because apparently she gave, like, the wife of Feanor could tame Feanor, but eventually that just didn't work out, and she gave only some of her qualities to each of her sons, but not one of them was exactly like her. So they're all kind of hotheads. So Finway's like, whatever, I'm still young, I'm only like 2000, I'm gonna marry.
They're also redheads, right? I mean, right. At least has red hair. I guess three of her children have red hair, I think.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
They were all golden-haired beauties.
Well, I know Feanor, wasn't he dark-haired? So
yeah, black hair.
That's right.
Yeah. So Finwë wants to remarry, and so he remarries this other Vanyar, and Feanor's like, well, that fucking sucks, because both of my stepbrothers, like, are douches, so I'm just going to work, like, by myself, like, out in wherever he is, like, in his own mansion workshop. So he does that. So now the 9,000-year imprisonment of Melkor is up. So, I mean, I'm guessing 3,000 years in age, and it is for three ages. So they bring him to Valmar. And there he, like, sues for pardon. And, you know, I think it was Olmo was not deceived, and Tulkas clenched his hands whenever he saw Melkor go by. because Manwë, in all his infinite wisdom, pardons Melkor because he's like, I don't even understand evil. So, you know. So then Melkor, like, tries to behave himself, but really in his heart is like, he's like, God damn it, you guys have it all together, and I don't have anything. So he just starts being, like, a little, like, mean girl's gossip queen, and starts spreading all these, like, rumors around the Noldor, and which will eventually lead to them creating weapons instead of just, like, gems and beautiful things. And, yeah, it just kind of ends with, you know, no one ever hated Melkor more than Feanor, even though they're both, like... Melkor will say, like, oh, no, I taught Feanor everything he knows. And Feanor's like, that's bullshit. And, you know, you got nothing. So, and he's the first one that will call him Morgoth. And as far as the summary, I mean, it's only, like, a six-page chapter, maybe. Not even. So, that's a summary.
Does anybody else think it's strange that Nienna, like, was one of the people championing Melkor to let him out?
Well, it makes sense because she's at least the closest. I mean, like, her specialty is sorrow, and he's created a crap ton of sorrow, so she at least would know that.
It was a job decision.
Yeah.
She's like, guys, I got nothing to do since he's been gone.
Yeah, she's running out of things to be sorrowful for.
Yeah, it makes sense. But I like how Tulkas is like, I'm having none of it. I'm no way. I just want to wrestle this guy, and he cannot wait to wrestle him again.
I've, you know, because I've punched him so many times in his face, I know what he's like, so, you know.
Yeah, but actually, an interesting thing about Tulkas is he didn't fight Melkor at all. He just clenched his fist because it was the judgment of Manwë, and they can't rebel against it because they'd be doing the same thing as Melkor did.
Right.
I liked how they said, didn't they say that Feanor, he did learn from Melkor, but, I mean, you know, they both talk shit after the fact, but they said that all of his mistakes, quote unquote, he was never fooled at all by Melkor, even though he eventually does a lot of evil, where a lot of evil comes from his actions. I don't know, because I haven't read ahead and I never read it, but I know he's responsible for a lot of harm, but it's basically all him, you know. I thought that was interesting that, you know, it wasn't really the trickery of Melkor that is, you know, a result of Feanor.
Well, it says that Melkor indeed declared afterwards that Feanor had learned much art from him in secret, and had been instructed by him in the greatest of all his works, but he lied in his lust and his envy, for none of the Eldalier ever hated Melkor more than Feanor, who named him Morgoth. So, yeah. So he, like, talked it up, but he was all talking. It was all air.
Lust. Okay.
Words are wind.
Yeah, self-aggrandizement, right? So, yeah.
Did they mention the creating of weapons in this chapter? I know you talked about it, but I didn't think they did yet.
No, not yet.
No, but they just start talking about like the whispers that Melkor is doing that creates that like unrest and probably does obviously does influence Fëanor. I mean, he's kind of a dick anyway, but like it's kind of like feeding his like internal fire.
Yeah, because I just feel like the Valar would have been like, "Hey, Fëanor, what the fuck you need a sword for, dude? There's nothing here to hurt you."
Yeah, I don't. As of now, Fëanor hasn't really done anything to make us take a step back. But we get to the point later where it's like, "Are we supposed to like this guy? Because he's not a knight. He doesn't do anything particularly likable." Yeah. It's good to have someone to root for, but it's tough to like. I like the elves that kind of stayed behind this one because they're like, "Yeah, we're not following you because you're crazy."
Yeah,
but at the same time,
I'm not crazy. I'll
like,
kill you.
But it's still understandable why he does what he does later on, I think.
Oh no, I understand everything he does. I never don't understand it, but I rarely agreed with it.
Which is why I'm always when people tell me like, you know, subversion of fantasy tropes, right? This is it, right? Basically, because throughout the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, you've been told like the elves, they're so nice, they're so friendly. And you know now you've sort of you sort of see that they you know they're individuals they are sort of at least partially also victim to the normal tempest that you know and yeah that's why I mean that's why it's probably very difficult to reconcile the two. All the elves in Lord of the Rings are sort of like they're very laid back and all that stuff, so yeah, but that's probably because they've been through a lot of stuff by that time, so I don't know.
Right. They have some experience.
Yeah, yeah. It's like they had to calm down after a millennia of fighting, so it's okay. Let's just enjoy life.
And they can't even do that because Sauron's back. Did anyone have anything else overall just for like the arc of the story as to where it's going, or just any last comments about anything that was brought up?
I think this is rising tension. As at this point, this is sort of like, you know, we know what Melkor is thinking. Now you sort of know where things are probably going to go, at least, you know, because he's in Aman. It's actually much more dangerous than it was before. We at least know from his thoughts that he's envious and all that stuff.
But none of that is outward, though. It's all inner monologue.
No, that's what I mean. But as a reader, we probably can guess what I mean, if we are not already familiar with the story, we can sort of guess where it's headed.
I don't know. Can we, Shane?
We definitely know Fëanor is going to cause some shit, basically.
Also, a big giveaway is when they say, like, noontime. It was the noontime in Valinor. It's like, oh, crap.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's about to get dark.
Still better than Twilight, right?
Right. Well, they mentioned a couple times of this, like, I think it's Fëanor. No, Finwë's wife says, like, don't blame me for all this stuff that's going to happen. Like, there's this sense of building doom. They call it doom a couple times. You know, I am blameless in what Fëanor is going to do because it's all him, not me. You know, but just the fact that he, like, drains her life force through the birth is kind of just, that's one of the first, you know, red flags.
Right.
And she's like, I can't do it. I'm going to die on an island. I can't do that again.
And that's one of those things that, you know how they say the elves dwindle and they don't, like, procreate very quickly, but maybe it is because they lose life force to like create a new life. They actually lose a piece of themselves into them. So maybe that's why elves dwindle, because you can't give them everything you have.
I think in Lord of the Rings or whatever, they're like, we'll diminish it into like a rustic folk of the Dell or something like that. So like kind of like elves as like kind of find like an Irish, you know,
fairy
stories. Yeah, fairy stuff rather than.
Well, Dwindle is a really cool elf name, like Dwindle the Elf.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Shorty the Hobbit or something.
Fatty.
So yeah, stuff is going down. The stage is set for what's coming next. I think that wraps up number two. Sorry if it was a little specific at some point, but it's really tough to make some of this what happens in this book seem interesting, because it really is a lot of info dump. I mean, once Fëanor's story kind of takes off, then it's a much more this happened then this happened, and it's you're caught up in it. But there's just so much backstory that needs to be there, and that's also one of the drawbacks. Well, like you said, a lot of people can't get into it because it's the story really it's not much plot, it's a lot of backstory. At least until this point. Right.
I think that later on it's just going to, you know, the pace is going to pick up. But at the same time, yeah, this is sort of a story that takes more than one lifetime, basically. It's a sort of like it spans different... I mean, it's a long time, basically, because, you know, Melkor is immortal. And so it's like, you know, you're fighting against an enemy that is... He's really old and he's actually damn formidable. I think this sort of makes sense. It's sort of putting the context... It's at least epic in the sense, like, I don't think that people read Beowulf because they are interested in the plot. They're interested in it because it's epic. It's an epic poem. Mm-hmm. So it's like, this is sort of the same. I mean, it's sort of a similar, you see the scale of what's at stake before it actually goes into, you know, fight round one, something like that, you know?
Right. But it will. And that's coming up in the near future. So thanks everyone for joining us for round number two. And if you have any questions about stuff we've covered or stuff that's coming up in the upcoming chapters, you can post that in the forum thread, and we'll get to that.
I'm sure there won't be anything. I think we did a great job, but they'll know all the names.
Well, I was thinking putting up an actual quiz or like something they could take, like, because I feel like we've given people so much information. But there, I was going to read a Tolkien quiz, but I'm quite exhausted at this point.
Yeah, I think that'll be.
We've been over 2 hours, I guess. No.
All right. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Yeah. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Bye.
Dwarf's still going to need wood. Don't. Don't. Don't.
And that's why, I mean, later we will see what the relationship between Fëanor and his half-brothers is, actually. And so Fëanor is the best with words and hands, so he's the big, you know, the big cheese in creating stuff. Fingolfin is the strongest, most resistant, and the bravest. Finarfin is the most beautiful and wise. So they also all have children, right? And so Fëanor, he has 7 sons, Maedhros. Maglor, he's a good singer. Celegorm the Fair, he likes huntling and is a friend to Orome, but he doesn't have a... I mean, we will see how his sense of justice develops later on. I mean, and then there's Caranthia, the dark, because he's the harshest and quick to anger. Corofin, the crafty, who is Fëanor's favorite, and he's actually father to Celebrimbor, who forged the Rings of Power. And then we have the last two, which are Amroth and Amras. And they were twins and the youngest, and they would be great hunters. That's all we know for now. Fingolfin basically had also 3 children with Anaire, I think is she called. He had a daughter, Aridel, the white, who was pale. That's, I don't know if it's because she was pretty or because she was, you know, just didn't go out in the sun much, but we don't know.
It wasn't the sun yet.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah, she was the long. But probably she slept too long. But yeah, and so she was actually strong and loved, and she liked to hunt, and she was often in company of Fëanor's sons, then her cousins. But she made it clear that she didn't want to be married to any one of them. So yeah, that's a bit weird, like incestual elves. So she's later the mother of Maeglin. And we'll see what he does, which is, you know, awkward as well. And so the last one of the three is Finarfin, who was the most beautiful and wise of Finwë's children, obviously. But yeah, he married Eärwen, which is, I mean, also like sometimes Tolkien just adds one letter to a name that already exists. So it's like Eärwen, yeah.
Hey, as far as we know, this name came first, and he took a letter off it.
Oh, could be, yeah. But it's like, she's the daughter of Olwë. And so their kids are Galadriel, Finrod, later called Felagund, so it's the hewer of caves. Then we have Orodreth, Angrod, and Aegnon. And those are all very close friends to Fingolfin's son, and they're like brothers. That's at least what we know from this chapter.
Dwarf's still gonna need blood. Don't, don't, don't.
Welcome to the call, though, man.
Yeah, thanks. It's a podcast celebrity with us.
Oh, I'm actually not. I wouldn't say that was Stephen Colbert, but Stephen Colbert would tell you the same thing anyway.
Right, exactly.
It's a very nice accent you have there.
Oh, do I actually? Oh, yeah, okay. I'm actually from Belgium, so that's why.
Bina's going to be jealous we got to talk to you first.
Yeah.
actually, I tried to add her to my contact list, and she wasn't sure who it was at first because probably she hadn't checked my Skype username first. And so I suppose now it's cleared up. Now that I know how Skype works, I hope to be on many more VOKs in the future, actually.
Nice.
Fantastic.
Dwarf's still going to need blood. Don't. Don't. Don't.
keep this summarily in discussion to an hour or so. I don't want it to go too much longer. But yeah. Everybody's good to go.
Oh, man. I think we can go. Got an hour worth right here. Sorry,
yeah,
guys.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I got a couple of pages on my 2 pages chapter.
Yeah, this is stuck. It's like you're trying to like whittle it down, but everything's so whittled down. It's like, well, okay.
Mine is about traveling, actually, and it's like 3 pages of summaries already. It's just, I don't know.
I might have to do some editing.
No more hours, actually.
The chapter is just 5 pages, and I have 3 pages of summary. Weird.
It's crazy.
That's all right. We'll get to it. No one's going to complain that we're talking too much about the summary, I don't think. I just know it's weird hours for some people, so I wouldn't want to keep people up more than they have
to.
Yeah,
but I'm fine with this. You know, I'm actually it's 4 a.m. here anyway. Oh, 5 a.m. now. I think I can manage it.
I won't call you German. You're Belgian. I don't want to.
I'm Belgian German actually.
Okay.
I used to live in Germany for 12 years, and then I moved to Belgium actually.
Okay. So I won't call you a kraut or anything at any point during the discussion.
No, that would probably just stir up some. I don't know some.
We won't mention the war. What war? No war. Won't mention the war.
Not yet, anyway.
Right. All right. So everyone's good to go.
Dwarf's still gonna need blood.
I like the recaps just because if someone is listening and doesn't read the books, they can follow along and still enjoy it.
Absolutely. Otherwise, there's just going to be 6 people listening to this.
Right. Us. We're going to listen to it.
Right.
Yeah.
And it also adds a little, you know, levity to it, which there's no levity in this, in the Silmarillion at all.
Right. Dwarf's still going to need blood.
But I did find there is a very good Tolkien quiz book by Andrew Murray, and I found my notes that I'd written in it when I took this quiz on June 2nd, 2006. And I got 6.5 points out of the 10 questions. I missed a couple, but we'll ask them next time.
Did you give yourself half a point?
Well, yeah, because some of the questions asked 2 questions, and I gave myself half a point there. Where did Namo live and what was his role? I got the first half. So.
Dwarf's still going to need blood.
As I was making my notes at the bottom of the dock, I just kept any time a new name for the elves came up, I put it there. I was like, okay, we got 4, and we got 6, and we ended up, I believe, with 12 different groups of elves. And as far as I can tell, 6 of them are exactly the same. But and it's weird; he picks and chooses when to call them the Quendi or the Eldar or the Avari and like the Falmari and the Falathrim seem to be pretty much exactly this, but the, you know, depends on where they went. But
yeah, it's all about the events in their lives.
Exactly, and that makes sense from a what you would call yourselves. But you'd think as a narrator, he would tell you what they are.
Yeah, but at least for the moment, the elves are not sort of they don't separate it by anything other than geographical location. We'll see that they will probably not. This will not probably stay just. It will not be limited just at that, right? They're going to split up into different groups based on completely different criteria, right? It's maybe that's a bit of foreshadowing, so to say, like, okay, these are, I mean, it's the sundering of elves, right? So it's like, yeah, they are part, but at least they're one common people. They are sort of like, they feel like they are akin, and we'll see that might not necessarily last for forever.